You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 119. And with me tonight I have a special guest, Clinton Baston, who is a longtime expert on nuclear fuel recycling. He worked for the Department of Energy and associated organizations for, maybe 40 years before he retired.
Years.
How long?
42 years.
Wow. And Clinton retired from the Department of Energy in 1997 and remained active in thinking and writing about the topic, and recently published a very interesting article on nuclear fuel recycling in 21st century technology. Welcome, Clinton.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So since Clinton published his article, I have been in touch with him and exchanging emails about some discussions and very strong feelings that he has with regard to the integral fast reactor, which is a rather popular thought about how to do nuclear recycling or fuel recycling. So, Clinton, can you share some of the things that we've been talking about with regard to the difference between the proven processes that were done, say, at Savannah River Plant and maybe in France, and the integral fast reactor?
Yes, the traditional and successful reprocessing has been done and is being done with what's called the solvent extraction. Actually, it's a chemical, tributyl phosphate, dissolved in a kerosene that is mixed with the nuclear material, nuclear fuel that's dissolved in water and acid. And the solvent, the chemical tributyl phosphate in the kerosene, as it mixes, the plutonium and uranium are transferred into the solvent, leaving the waste behind in the water. That's basically the way the process works. It's a very simple process. It has complexities because of the high levels of radiation and the need for pure products from the process. The solvent extraction actually takes place in many stages of solvent extraction. The process used for the integral fast reactor reprocessing and recycle is called pyroprocessing. And actually, there have been two development programs for use of pyroprocessing. The initial program carried out by Argonne National Laboratory was based on a process, it's called slag reduction, which is similar to what's used for processing iron from iron ore. And it's not a high recovery process. There are large losses, and that process was abandoned 30 or 40 years ago. The newer process uses a different technique, but it's still a metallurgical process. It's called electrorefining. The plutonium and uranium, and or the uranium, can be separated from the fission products, or most of the fission products, by simply electro-refining. And it's a very complex process. It's done at high temperatures, and is only applicable for very small, and in my opinion, laboratory-type operations. Now, those are the basic problems. The power processing, like most metallurgical processing of ore, as I mentioned, has high losses. The Durex processing, such as that at the Savannah River plant and in France, the losses are less than 2%. And at the Savannah River plant, that includes downstream processing of plutonium as well, because the scrap that is generated and would be lost is returned to the reprocessing plant for recovery, and it's recovered at a very high rate.
Now, one of the things that we've discussed is some of the specific facility design characteristics that allowed for high throughput and high reliability that you don't see as having been done yet for something like the pyroprocessing. There's still a lot of engineering work to be done before that's really ready for
small-scale. Well, yeah, the pyroprocessing requires different types of materials that are not really, such as large tungsten and other exotic materials to contain the nuclear and other materials at high temperatures, and to process it, the piping, the other material. Now, the maintenance of that equipment is has to be very complex too, and is time consuming. It's generally done with hand operated multi-slave manipulators. The reprocessing at the Savannah River plant, the facility, the equipment is relatively simple and reliable, and it simply is not repaired in place, but it's designed so that it can be removed, and the pipe connections disconnected by a remote, actually by an overhead crane with an impact wrench and a hook to lift the equipment and the pipes and to disconnect the remote connectors. So if you have a failure in a piece of equipment, major piece of equipment at the Savannah River plant, it takes about one day to remove it and move it to a decontamination area where it can be later repaired. But the spare is installed, and the facility is ready to start operation within one day or less. Now, furthermore, the process equipment at the Savannah River plant is maintained with storage tanks for process solutions between solvent extraction cycles, because when you first start the solvent extraction process, the extraction is not complete. It has to operate over a period of time. And if you begin transfer of solution to the second cycle prior to the time you've reached equilibrium, then the second cycle will have extra work to do and will not be able to make it, so it will be pure enough at the third cycle. By storing solutions in tanks between those cycles, you avoid that kind of problem. And so at Savannah River plant, we could start operation, and things would be at full capacity within initially one day, but initially 8 hours, but then later within just a few minutes of start of operation. At the Curex facility at Hanford, they did not have that tankage to store solutions between cycles, and it took 8 days to restart. In in the case of the IFR, it's probably going to take, well, it'll take a long time between, after maintenance, where it takes a long time for maintenance and repair, and then a considerable, like, you have to start heating everything up and so forth and so on. So it's a very, very long process. Now, that's one of the major problems. The other major problem with the integral fast reactor is the great difficulty in measuring nuclear materials to assure that there has been no diversion. In the research program, typically the measurement is made less than once a year, and that's just totally inadequate. Purex processing, the measurement is made very easily. Samples are withdrawn, taken to a laboratory and analyzed, and we have a good handle on the assurance of safeguards. Those are some of the differences in, well, I talked about the differences in the solvent extraction processes and the power processing, but also some of the solvent extraction processes at Savannah River Plant and at Hanford and at Idaho were quite different. At Idaho, the maintenance system was simply by having people go in and doing things by hand after some decontamination, but still the highly radioactive operation and maintenance.
Now, one of the things that I've been reading about for a long time is some of the large amounts of liquid effluent from the recycling facilities. Is there any way to reduce the amount of liquid that's left over after the process is done, or are we limited to having to figure out a way to dispose of that?
Well, the liquid waste in France are converted to glass and stored. I'm just writing something about this. The highly radioactive fission products in nuclear fuel, used nuclear fuel, are very, very small. Actually, the amount of waste from a nuclear fission process is about 1/10 millionth of the waste from use of fossil fuels. So the waste are actually quite small, relatively speaking. Now, in reprocessing, In the early reprocessing, in the 40s and 50s, there was some evaporation of waste and conversion of the, waste into highly reactive material and very, very low radioactive material that we discharged to seepage basins. It's fairly easy to separate the waste from the water and convert the waste. I'll say it's very easy. It's done and has been done for years in France and Japan and in other places. We could have done it here years ago, but we, for reasons that are in my paper, we did not do so. But basically, if the waste can be reduced, to much smaller volumes, but the problem is not really so much the volumes of the waste. It is the fact that we have not moved forward with the reprocessing and recycle technology, nor programs to properly process the waste.
Is the Savannah River Plant recycling facility still operational?
It's operational. Not... They don't do very much. It was designed to produce, it was designed and built to produce and process nuclear materials for many, many purposes, actually, including defense, space exploration, and a lot of other things. We produced the plutonium-238 at the Savannah River Plant that was used to provide power for space satellites to go to distant planets, Mars, Jupiter, and so forth, Galileo and
Cassini was the last one.
Cassini was the one that went to Saturn. Galileo went to Jupiter. So plutonium 238 produced at the Savannah River plant was used to power to provide electricity for the instruments and computers and so forth on those space satellites. And we no longer make plutonium 238. We no longer process that. We no longer produce plutonium. So the material, I believe one of the reprocessing plants is still in operation, but it's used only sparingly.
Yeah, it's interesting that we've been talking a lot about recycling recently, and I haven't read very many people suggest that what we should be doing is using the facility we have to demonstrate various ways of reusing the materials that are currently being considered waste products.
We were planning to do that at the Savannah River plant during the 60s and, well, during the 60s, actually. But by the time the problems developed with some of the commercial facilities, the amount of fuel in the light water reactors throughout the nation and elsewhere was much too much to reprocess at the Savannah River plant. Now, the Savannah River plant facilities do not have the fuel in power reactors is different cladding and different material than that in production in Savannah River plant reactors. It requires a different treatment prior to processing than is available in those existing tanks. Now, we were planning to install some equipment that would do the job, but it would be only on a small scale. Now, yeah, you could do a demonstration, but you could not do a significant amount, in those facilities, not anything like the amount needed to, dispose of scrap fuel and disposal. Well, we recycle all the plutonium and uranium and dispose of the permanent disposal of the nuclear waste.
Now, one of the things that you made clear to me was that one difference between the Purex process, the aqueous solution, and the pyroprocessing is one's a continuous process and one is a batch process.
Yes, right. That's correct. Yeah, continuous process. Once you start going, you just keep going and run indefinitely. You might need, well, if you shut down because of a failure. But the batch process, you start and quite frankly, this was one of the things that disturbed me. They're planning to run a demonstration, and the plans in the early 90s were to have a demonstration of the process at the fuel cycle facility in Idaho. But the demonstration was only for a single run. So you wouldn't really establish the capacity of the plant by just that one run, because you really have to know how long is it going to take you after the completion of the first batch until you can start the next batch. And I think the answer is it would be a long time, and that just never did get answered. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you... It's an unknown. It would be a long time, but I don't really know how long.
Yeah, one of the things that I found over my career is that a lot of demonstrations leave a lot to be desired from the point of view of seeing how it really is going to work in operation. I can't tell you how many times I've seen a computer program demonstration that's being run on a single computer for a system designed to be run on a network, for example. And it just doesn't show you all the things that are going to happen.
It sure doesn't. And that particular one didn't show anything. You know, in World War II, we built a pilot plant, or DuPont built a pilot plant, to conduct experiments prior to building and operating the facilities at Hanford, the production and processing facilities at Hanford. Well, the pilot plant there was just for those experiments. But then Oak Ridge scientists that stayed behind after DuPont left started running that and convinced themselves that they had a real, honest-to-God, production operation. They actually recovered 39 grams of plutonium in a year's campaign. And I don't know how long, you know, I don't really know how long, what was the time between. But, it, you know, 39, but they thought they'd recovered a lot more for some reason. And they decided, the Atomic Energy Commission later decided to use that concept to build the Idaho Chemical Processing Plant based on that single demonstration, which was totally inadequate for any kind of demonstration.
But that's
the kind of thing that happened there.
Yeah, that's one of the things I've always admired about Admiral Rickover's demonstration at the prototype in Idaho for the Nautilus. Once he got that plant up and running, he forced the engineers to make it run the equivalent of running around the ocean.
Absolutely right. In fact, you know, one of the best developments, and I'm sorry, I consider myself sort of the godfather of this, is a centrifugal contactor. It was a development program at the Savannah River Laboratory, and I was intrigued by the thing. But we had that development equipment ran for thousands of hours, actually many thousands of hours continuously, demonstrated very reliable operation before we built the demonstration unit for putting in the reprocessing plant. And that was what led, the use of that equipment was what led to a reduction in time from startup to full production, reduction from about 8 hours to just a few minutes. So, but yeah, absolutely. Anything that we were going to use, DuPont ran it long periods of time, just same way that Rickover did. But they also, I think both Rickover and DuPont had made darn sure that the operators and the managers knew what was going on. And at Savannah River Plant, one of the things that Savannah River Plant had the best ever safety records for the Atomic Energy Commission. And the major reason was the fact that managers met with workers once a week to go over safety concerns and get them resolved. And that was, those were some of the things that I've been promoting most of my career, the ideas of doing that. And I think I mentioned they were adopted by the Russian Ministry for Atomic Energy and the Russian Nuclear Workers Union. How successful they've been, I'm not really sure, but I hope it's been good.
Yeah. Now
most countries use that sort of process, France, Japan, and so forth, to make sure that there's good understanding of things. Anyway.
You were pretty active in the labor organizations within the Department of Energy. Can you talk a little bit about some of the challenges that you had over the years?
Well, I joined the union in 1983, and I won't go into details, but I joined the union. I had been a manager most of my career, and not a union member, but I joined the union, and almost immediately the field representative, there was actually a downtown chapter in at the Forrestal building, and the members in the Germantown, which was the old AEC headquarters where most of the technical people worked, were members, but they were sort of isolated from what was going on. But anyway, as soon as I joined, the field representative from the national office, I met her, and next thing I know, the president of the union had asked me to be acting president for a new chapter that would represent these people. And I agreed to do so, and that was my role for 1983 through almost the time I retired. I tell you, there were several things, and one of the things that was most interesting to me personally was the work on improved relations between people of different cultures, and also to try to develop our union actually worked with the Department of Treasury to introduce partnership processes to improve quality of operations in Department of Treasury programs. And we did the same kind of thing in the Department of Energy. I actually had relations with the Secretary of Energy that were like partnership, and I was able to make input to them about problems. But also, there were not good feelings between people of different cultures, particularly between African-Americans and others. And I had some good friends that were African-American scientists, really almost Nobel quality prize winner. But they got very active in trying to reduce problems there, but also trying to develop the partnership processes to improve quality and improve processes for resolution of conflicts between workers and managers on a personal level. And that was, both of those were most interesting and enjoyable, and when we were able to have successes. Now, there was one other thing. If you look at the nuclear industry, or at that time, you didn't find any African Americans, and it tended to be a standoff by many about nuclear power. And we actually formed a partnership with the Secretary of Energy and the Office of Nuclear Energy to create a chair at Morgan State University, which is a historically black college, in the name of what's the guy's name? Wilcox. He's a professor he was a professor of physics and a president of the American Nuclear Society. He was a professor at one of the Atlanta universities. But anyway, a chair was established in his name, and then we actually supported a co-op program for African-American workers to come in, or students to work at the Department of Energy, Office of Nuclear Energy, during their time away from work. And those were really enjoyable things for me. Of course, we negotiated contracts and all the other things, which were interesting, but I really enjoyed, I tell you, in our offices, we had our Black History Month celebrations were just outstanding. We had gospel singers from several neighborhood churches. That was just really outstanding, and I particularly love that stuff, too. Anyway.
Now, one of the other, obviously the importance of getting everybody on board with a safety culture and having good feedback between managers and workers is an extremely important part of any good functioning organization, particularly in a business like nuclear power, where everybody's on the same team and has to perform in order for very expensive equipment to keep operating safely and reliably. One of the things that I read between the lines in your correspondence with me was that you had a lot of admiration for the way DuPont ran their facilities and designed the facilities for actual real people to manage and maintain, and not so much belief or respect for the designs from a certain other company whose initials are GE.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that one other thing that DuPont did, I mentioned the insurance of managers meeting with workers once a week, but also DuPont on new equipment designs, new facility designs, etc. The project managers would come to Wilmington, Delaware, and actually go over their plans with the executive boards and the financial boards, the senior officials of DuPont, and, you know, get their input. These are the guys that had managed, you know, plants all over the world and had good understanding of all of the kinds of facilities that were built. The engineering department was a part of DuPont. The construction crews were integral with DuPont. Now, General Electric at Hanford, now here's the major difference between the Savannah River plant. When DuPont came in World War II, and when Truman asked them to come in at the Savannah River plant, they said yes, but they would manage those operations the same way they manage commercial facilities with their corporate enterprise. And now the fee that DuPont charged for the service was only $1, but the cost of operations included the overhead for those managers in Wilmington. And when General Electric came in, they did not ask for that, and they did not have the corporate management that was needed. And actually, they recognized that, and they recognized that that was a failure, and that's the reason they left Hanford. But they made the same mistake at the Marks plant. They did not have a management review of that plant until after it ran into very serious problems prior to start of operations. Now, you know, I don't know. I'm sure in some, you know, I have a high regard for General Electric, but not in that particular area.
So the problem was the oversight by experienced plant managers and engineers wasn't there.
That's correct. Experienced plant managers and program managers and heads of departments and so, you know, these are people way up in the organization. They had been plant managers and laboratory directors earlier and so forth and so on. But these were the top people. And the people on the projects, not the manager of the operation, but the actual manager of the project would go make the briefing. And in some cases, some of the specialists in certain areas, the actual people doing the work did the briefing. So the full input was, they looked at it very, very thoroughly. And I'll tell you, occasionally we would have smaller projects that would not go through that process at the Savannah River plant. And I learned very carefully. I learned to be very, very careful. You know, I had, in my job, final say-so for AEC money to be funded for any kind of project. And I learned to be very, very careful in supporting a project that did not have the corporate overview, the corporate engineering by DuPont. And I tell you, at Hanford, after I left the Savannah River plant, I had responsibility in headquarters for all of the operations at Hanford and Idaho, and then eventually for trying to resolve commercial reprocessing plant problems.
So how frustrating was it for you to be at DOE from 1992 to 1997?
From 1992 to, well, wait a minute. I started, DOE started in 78.
Right, but 1992 was when the Clinton administration came into office.
Actually, it was frustrating, but I got to the point, I wrote a letter that was published in the National Academy of Sciences publication, Issues in Science and Technology, and I sent a copy of it to Bill White, who was Deputy Secretary of Energy. He's now mayor of Houston and being considered, he may have a job for Barack Obama, but I don't know. But anyway, I sent a copy of it. I got a note from him saying, hey, he liked my letter and would like to meet with me. We had a great conversation and start a partnership, and we did. Now, one of the first, now I worked in the Office of Nuclear Energy, and Terry Lash was named, not Assistant Secretary, but head of the Office of Nuclear Energy. Terry had been a technical person with the Natural Resources Defense Council, which is tended to be sort of anti-nuclear, and he sort of had a chip on his shoulder. After I met with Bill White, I called Terry and asked for a meeting with him. Actually, Terry had been the NRDC staff technical advisor when they sued Hanford AEC for its waste management practices. And I actually gave a briefing for managers at Hanford that ended up, that resulted in them settling the suit by agreeing to what NRDC wanted them to do. But anyway, that's a long story. But anyway, right after Hazel O'Leary came in as secretary, I met with her and had just a very brief chat, and she said she was interested in meeting with me. We had a meeting. Well, let me mention my first meeting with Terry didn't go very well. I mentioned it to Bill White, and he called both of us in, and he said, you will work as partners. And from that time, Terry and I got along fine. But in October of 1993, I met with Secretary O'Leary, and we had a really good meeting, and, you know, everything was really great. And then I went to Japan, and it was on a special delegation for work, and I met with the president of Japan Power Reactor and Nuclear Fuel Development Corporation. I think his name was Ishii Watari. But shortly after I got back, I found a copy of a letter on my desk. It was signed by Hazel O'Leary to Ishii Watari, chewing him out about a videotape on plutonium, Mr. Plutonium, I think the thing was called, which was poo-pooed the dangerous, toxic nature of plutonium, which it is not, but it is alleged to be. And I wrote a letter to Secretary O'Leary that sort of chewed her out. It was highly critical of the letter. It had a lot of mistakes in it. It was really, apparently Terry had drafted the letter. But anyway, that led eventually to a very powerful partnership. And sometime later, I actually testified in Congress on some of our partnership activities for reducing the Department of Energy. And I made some very, very powerful supporting arguments for what she had done, and for which really became an outstanding result for me, because she actually called me in and wanted to have regular meetings, and every time I sent her an email message, she would read it and respond to it, and generally do what I suggested that she do. So, now, the Department of Energy was going through a down. We didn't do anything worth doing. But we didn't do anything worth doing the entire time that I worked for the Department of Energy. I can't think of anything we did that was really worth doing. Now, so the whole experience of the Department of Energy was very frustrating. The last year I was there, I gave a talk at a Global Foundation conference. That's a conference at the University of Miami in Miami, Florida, people like Glenn Seaborg, Hans Bethe, Edward Teller, and so forth were trustees or principals and so forth and so on. But anyway, my talk was on the need for a new approach or new vision for dealing with our energy and nuclear problems other than the Department of Energy. And, you know, there were a lot of, actually, the frustrations were much less during the Clinton administration than at other times because they supported my trips to Russia and, you know, paid for my trip over there to give two talks and also to do some other things. So that time out of it was pretty good, but, you know, it's also frustrating because we were not really addressing America's energy challenges. And that, you know, that was not just from 92. That was from roughly 70, well, I won't say, from roughly 75 on, we had sort of a dysfunctional system.
Now, up until 74, I think, is when the Atomic Energy Commission existed.
Yes.
Now, can you tell me a little bit about what happened? Why did the Atomic Energy Commission get disbanded and turned into the Energy Research, NR, I can't remember what it was,
Energy Research and Development Initiative. Well, I think for two reasons. Number one, the regulatory function was within the Atomic Energy Commission, and that was considered a conflict of interest. Part of the process was creating the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And then you had the Bureau of Mines that was dealing with coal research development and so forth. The organization was created to give attention to energy challenges, Energy Research and Development Administration, alternative energies, fossil energy, and nuclear energy, put them all in one box. And the AEC was disbanded, and unfortunately, what really happened was that the nuclear people that were appointed, well, during the last few years of the Atomic Energy Commission, most important, we faced up to a lot of problems that had developed early and set about addressing them. In the last few years, the Atomic Energy Commission started providing accurate information to Americans about a lot of information. Actually, it began with when Seaborg was chairman, Glenn Seaborg was chairman, to provide accurate information about any kind of incident, accident, and so forth. And during the last few years, and that was my major role the last few years of the Atomic Energy Commission, to look into and try to resolve and make changes to address the fuel reprocessing and recycle challenges. And that resulted in, you know, change of organization within headquarters, reassignments to DuPont instead of the National Laboratories, and, you know, addressing the real problems that needed to be resolved. We met with everybody, including the Edison Electric Institute and so forth and so on, and got a pretty good handle on the thing. And then when Energy Research and Development Administration came, they all threw it away and so forth. The basic problem in nuclear is that nuclear engineers do not understand the complexities of reprocessing, and scientists in laboratories don't understand it either. That's the problem. And so the nuclear program managers would listen to laboratory people talk about their great experience, had no concept of whether it was good or not, but they would just buy off on it. That's really what the promoters of the integral fast reactor were nuclear engineers that wanted to see something cheap and it would hopefully do the job. But that's really the problem.
Now, your background actually is as a chemical engineer. Is that correct?
Well, I was a chemical engineer, but also got involved in all the nuclear stuff all immediately. I got involved in an international program. I had responsibility for production and distribution of heavy water and recycle of heavy water from reactors. Well, one of the problems there were problems with use of heavy water in the reactors that involved tritium and so forth. So I got more involved in reactor operations just simply because of that. But I was at the Savannah River plant working with people that were operating the reactors, so I got to know a lot about it.
Well, what I meant by that was that a lot of times a person's initial education and background gives them a little different perspective. And a lot of the nuclear engineers that I've met couldn't tell you how to do a heat balance on a steam plant, for example.
Right.
All they understood was the nuclear physics calculations.
That's correct, yes.
And so the equipment that was all important in terms of converting the heat into useful power was something that was beyond them. They just didn't understand the equipment and the operations and how to make it reliable and that kind of stuff. And maybe the same thing
is
true.
That's not so much as the actual chemical processing. They don't understand in a reactor, you don't really do maintenance on the reactor. Well, you do some, but your maintenance on a reprocessing plant is quite different than it is in a reactor. But one of the things that I had responsibility for the heavy water production, which also included a steam plant which produced steam for the process and generated electricity. So I had responsibility for that. So I learned a little bit about that stuff too.
Yeah, well, I think that I had a lot of sailors that worked for me that went on to other types of process control jobs once they left, because the steam plant process control is not that much different from the process control in a large refinery or chemical plant. You still have all the pumps and valves and control systems and some of the same maintenance issues, I believe. And that's one of the, when you described to me how the systems were designed with removable equipment that you could, I guess with flanges or whatever, pull it out and bolt in a new one, that made a lot of sense.
Actually, you had on a pipe connector, for example, you had a connector with clamps on it that would clamp over the face plate and so forth and put it down. It was there would be a hex nut on the end with a pyramidal shape that an impact wrench could fit over and lock onto and open and close. But anyway, it was a very simple, very, very simple system.
In that plant, what kind of piping sizes would you be dealing with? Were they fairly small?
Two and a half inches, typically, in that range. There were some for samples that were smaller than that, but most of them were two-inch pipe.
Yeah, that's...
It's part of standard pipe, too.
Right, I kind of figured it was fairly small diameter pipe because of the concerns about criticality configuration.
But that was not the major reason.
Understand. There's certain things that we won't go into detail.
Yeah.
Understand. Okay. Well, sounds like we have an interesting time coming up, because there's an awful lot of folks these days who are quite enamored with the concept of the integral fast reactor.
Yeah.
The other piece for me that is a little bit challenging about that design, although there's some intriguing aspects, is it looks like they want to have a recycling facility with every reactor. And that sounds terribly expensive.
They call it the integral fast reactor. It would have a recycling facility with each reactor. Now, that's something also that I tend to shy away. I like reactor people operating reactors and reprocessing people operating a reprocessing plant some distance apart, because they are two distinctly different types of operations. But anyway, that probably is not an overwhelming thing. But I think, bear in mind that each reprocessing plant will require safeguards. So you have them spread all over the place. You got to, for international safeguards, that's, in my opinion, not a bit. Now, I'm intrigued by the process. I mean, I find it interesting. I think I may have mentioned I had responsibility at Savannah River for plutonium scrap recovery, and one of the processes used, we didn't use it, but it was used at Los Alamos, was electro-refining, which is sort of the heart of the integral fast reactor fuel cycle. So, yeah, it's interesting stuff, experimental stuff, but I think it's too difficult for the remote environment and for really the economic reality, the need for safe, successful operations, safeguards, and all the other things. I think it just, to me, it's out of the question.
Do you have any feelings about the Urex Plus compared to the Purex?
Urex is just simply an adaptation. That was in the designs that DuPont in a facility that DuPont was designed for for the Department of Energy. It was actually started with the Atomic Energy Commission, but that their facility would do Urex, Purex, or anything else. They're basically the same process. You just simply don't separate the plutonium and the uranium from each other, or you combine them, or you do whatever. You can do almost anything you want to do in a Purex process. Leave the plutonium with the uranium, leave the uranium with the waste, and take the plutonium. Anything. For example, we recovered neptunium from the in both Purex reprocessing plants, the one that stayed in use for Purex processing, and also the one that was modified for highly enriched uranium fuel reprocessing. But that's just a process, not a technology. And Urex process can be easily used in a Savannah River plant type reprocessing plant.
Did you have any experience with doing any work with thorium and uranium-233?
At Savannah River plant, we produced the uranium-233 for some early experimental reactor development work, and then later for some weapons tests. U-233 is a fissile material, and then also for the Navy program at Bettis and shipping port for the demonstration of a light water breather reactor. And that uranium-233 was produced with a low U-232 concentration so that it could be handled without use of remote systems.
Yeah, I'm very interested in that light water breeder reactor experiment. It seems to me that it was just fascinating the way that it operated for 5 years and had more fissile material in it at the end of the operation, it did at the beginning.
That's right. That's what breeders do. It's an excellent. The problem, Rod, when the Atomic Energy Commission died, sort of everything like that just sort of died with it.
Well, I have a very cynical view of why the Atomic Energy Commission got merged in with its competitors from other energy sources. I mean, the reality is the energy business is not just about technology. It's about competition in markets.
Yeah.
And the the people that wanted to continue the other types of energy didn't like having the atomic energy having its own funding paths and its own ways to develop new products without competing with them.
I know the attorneys in the Atomic Energy Commission that became attorneys in the Energy Research and Development Administration really went down hard on everything nuclear, and it may have well been for that reason. I sometimes suspect those types of things. There's so many reasons things go wrong. I worry about correcting them. But anyway, that was, what I maintain should be done now is you have some kind of, what the Department of Energy does and the Energy Research and Development Administration does is try to promote jobs for themselves. And the Atomic Energy Commission did a lot of that too. They would deliberately make things look a lot worse than they were in order to get funding for doing this, that, and the other. And an awful lot of that happened.
Right. It's hard to get funding to take care of something that's not a problem.
Yep.
So you have to make sure that it is a problem, or at least perceived to be a problem.
Our energy crisis that started in 1970 was a problem from then on. That's when they lost the ability to recover enough oil to meet demand, as had been predicted by, what's his name?
Hubbard.
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 Yeah, King Hubbard visited Savannah River Plant to review our waste disposal concept. And since he was chairman of the committee reviewing the Kansas salt mine approach, he poo-pooed our concept, which was later endorsed not only by a separate NAS committee, but by a committee appointed by the governor of South Carolina, and then just discarded by Schlesinger.
What was your concept?
My concept? Oh, put it in bedrock underneath. We would go, bedrock starts about 1,000 feet under the Savannah River Plant. On the top of bedrock is an impermeable layer of saprolite, which is clay created from decay of rock. You go down 500 feet and you're out of you're in the stable zone, not subject to earthquakes and so forth and so on. Put a cavern in there. You've got to contain essentially forever. Furthermore, the saprolite area, the water that's actually in the bedrock, the tritium concentration, the difference in tritium concentration below and water below the saprolite layer and that above the saprolite layer is indicative of geologic times of no transport across that barrier. That's the kind of thing. I mean, it was an overwhelming. It had overwhelming evidence of high integrity. And we could have disposed of all the nuclear waste from the Savannah River plant for, like $50 or $100 million. And, in fact, that was a major reason Allied General selected the Savannah River plant to build it, because they thought they would have a place to dispose of their waste.
Anyway. $50 or $100 million. When I was doing some research before our show, I took a look and realized that there was just a contract signed on December 8th at Savannah River Plant for continuation of the cleanup for a total of another $3 billion.
Yep.
And one of the things that Ted Rockwell and I have discussed many times is that, we're not really cleaning things up. What we're doing is putting money into a rat's pocket.
That's right.
And creating continued contracts for no real benefit.
Yeah, that thing was kicked off by an article that happened and it was published in MIT's Technology Review and then picked up by the Washington Post on the front page of their editorial pages, Sunday editorial pages. It was written by Bob Alvarez and Arjun Makajani. I wrote a letter to the editor of both. Technology Review published mine, the Washington Post did not. And the Department of Energy had a magnificent document that could have been used to refute the whole thing, but sat on it so that they would get the money for the $100 billion cleanup, which after our, after Bob Alvarez came to work for the Department of Energy in 1993, quickly grew to $400 billion and counting. And now, you know, maybe someday they'll stop, but I don't know. Bill Clinton, during the Clinton administration, they started cutting back on everything. You know, if the effort that Clinton had started had continued, the Department of Energy would be at a reasonable price, and we might have something else that would set policies for the nation, energy policies and direct programs for the nation. Something other than a dysfunctional system. Anyway.
Well, Clinton, it's been great talking to you. I hope we continue to correspond because I've got some more questions about what the Department of Energy is going to do in the future. I'm keeping a close eye on the new appointments. At least I'm somewhat encouraged because the new guy is at least a scientist and not a lawyer.
Well, I won't say. I won't comment. Scientists tend to like to promote their research. I did a paper on alchemy when I was in high school and in college, separate papers. There were scientists that wanted to have funding for their research.
Yeah, well, of course, I've never seen a scientific presentation where the last slide didn't include the statement of future work that needs to be funded and done.
You bet.
All right, take care, Clinton.
Okay, I enjoy it.
Hope you enjoyed that show. If you enjoy independent voices running on non-corporate media, please help the podcast network keep operating by giving a pledge. Visit tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com/pledge, and that will keep the servers running and the bandwidth flowing. Take care.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adams way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.